Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host. Today I'm joined by Professor Gordon Dutton, and we're going to be talking about cerebral visual impairment as well as functional visual loss. Gordon, thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast. You know, I was just wondering for the listeners if, before we go into the in detail about the topic, if you could perhaps define, you know, what is cerebral visual impairment, you know, also known as CVI?
Cerebral visual impairment is considered to be impairment of vision directly related to the visual brain, comprising the visual pathways, the posterior visual pathways, and the occipital lobes, and the association cortices, the posterior parietal lobes, and the temporal lobes.
Who do we see this condition in? You know, my understanding is that it's more common in children, you know, or the neonatal group, but is that right? And you know, do we see this in adults as well?
It can affect people of any age, right the way from starting with injury in utero into the last years of life, often due to ischemia in both categories.
What's actually going on, for example, in a neonate, in terms of the neurological anatomy? You know, when a child develops cerebral visual impairment, you know, what are the underlying causes of this?
There's a very wide range of causes. I teach medical students the thin maiden way of thinking: traumatic, hematologic, infective, neoplastic, metabolic, autoimmune, iatrogenic, degenerative, endocrine, not acquired. And any of those can cause brain injury, of course. But the majority are ischemic in one form or another.
So we know that, you know, in the neonatal group specifically, you know, this is more associated with, you know, preterm delivery or, you know, premature birth. You know, why is that association there?
Well, it's thought to be a key fact is that the anterior cerebral artery, the middle cerebral artery, and the posterior cerebral artery all have a confluence in the periventricular area, particularly posteriorly and superiorly. And that this, in turn, predisposes to a periventricular white matter pathology, which is ischemic in origin, because this vasculature is potentially at a greater risk of injury than any other part.
In children who present with, you know, CVI, cerebral visual impairment, you know, how might they present in the clinic?
Well, you can divide them into different groups. Those that have the severe form of pathology, who may present at birth with the presentation of "my child does not see," and on examination one finds no abnormality, normal electroretinography, and yet delayed VEPs or absent VEPs even, owing to profound brain injury. The later presentations are at the milder level, so that I've even seen children presenting as teenagers or in the infant school and a range between those, because the milder the presentation of the anomalies of vision that can occur with the range of cerebral visual impairments is vast.
So you said there that, you know, some diagnosis of cerebral visual impairment actually might be made in teenagers. Is this implying that this is a diagnosis that we've missed from birth?
Indeed. Because there is this idea abroad that vision is visual acuity. But of course, there's much more to vision than that. There is visual fields, visual acuity, contrast sensitivity. But then, in the association cortices, there is the ability to see a lot of things at once with your posterior parietal lobes, to guide your movement with your posterior parietal lobes, and to recognize what you see with your temporal lobes. Any of those can be affected by the disorder. But if your visual acuity is not reduced, then many erroneously think that vision is normal under those circumstances.
You've talked about, you know, many different aspects there of visual impairment, you know, visual field loss, contrast sensitivity, you know, there's object agnosia, the difficulty in recognizing people's faces. But, you know, what features of cerebral visual impairment might a patient with this condition suffer from?
In a sense, they don't necessarily suffer from it, because it may be asymptomatic, because they might not know they've got it because they've had it all their lives. And the terms of reference for normality is self. But others will notice, especially in children, that Yes, if there is occipital pathology, then the features relate to not being able to see things clearly due to acuity or contrast sensitivity. They relate to tripping and falling, often due to lower visual field impairment, because the superior posterior periventricular white matter lesions, which I've talked about, affect the peripheral lower visual field, often outside what we plot, and therefore they may not be detected. And then there are the pathologies related to the posterior parietal lobes, which map the scene for you, so you can, and you do this subconsciously, run up a flight of stairs, and you can talk on the phone because your feet know where they're going. And this mapping can be reduced, so such children can appear to be clumsy, but they're not. They've got impaired visual guidance of movement, which is called optic ataxia. And then, because the mapping might be deficient, they may see fewer items and become aware of fewer items, and that is called simultanagnosia, first described in 1908 by Balint, although the words was invented later. And then for the temporal lobes, the temporal lobes are responsible for recognizing. The fusiform gyrus on both sides in the inferior temporal lobe is the image library that enable us to recognize what we see and to create that picture in our minds, which is the emulation of the external world that we deem to be reality. And that recognition with the left temporal lobe lesions would affect the ability to see geometric shape and form and shapes and of objects, whereas the right temporal lobe tends to be give rise to lesions which relate to recognizing faces and recognizing where you are going, where things are kept, and routes and route planning. So all of those things can present. And then I've missed out the middle temporal lobes just in front of the occipital lobes, which serve movement perception. And interestingly, a large proportion of children born very prematurely don't see fast moving things. They have a degree of dyskinetopsia.
It seems from what you're saying there that it's a huge spectrum of symptoms in which this condition may manifest in. You know, but I think the really important question to ask you would be, you know, how common is this condition? And I appreciate that might be a difficult question to answer because, you know, as we've already acknowledged and discussed, this is a condition that on one side of the spectrum is quite easy to miss and may only be identified, you know, later in childhood.
I can really only speak to my own experience and some recent experiences that my colleagues that I've been helping in India have had. And that is, it's a lot more common than we might believe. So in an average year, towards the end of the time that I was working clinically, I would be identifying approximately 40 children each year who had cerebral visual impairment, serving a population of 1 million in the city of Glasgow. Whereas we'd be identifying something in the region of 6 or 8 cataracts, 3 or 4 glaucomas, and 1, maybe 2 retinoblastomas at the most. So yes, it comes out as being by far the most common cause of a difficulty with vision that I would see every year. The Indian study has shown that now that it's become recognised, my colleagues in two areas of India are finding it to be the commonest cause of visual impairment that they see too.
That's really interesting, you know, because clinically we've got an extremely well-established screening program for retinopathy of prematurity. You know, when we consider that cerebral visual impairment might be as common a cause of visual impairment in children, you know, do you think we should be screening more robustly for this condition instead or in addition to?
Our experience in Glasgow was that having recognised that children with disabilities are far more commonly affected by refractive error and impaired accommodation, as well as cerebral visual impairment, We have already set up screening, which has been running for over 10 years now, very successfully, with a very large proportion of children who are attending the development units where they were screened actually being found to have refractive errors, accommodative errors, and cerebral visual impairment. So yes, it's already happening in Glasgow, and why isn't it happening elsewhere?
Imagining that I'm sitting in the clinic and I've got a child in front of me who I suspect may have cerebral visual impairment, you know, do you think you might be able to give an overview of the clinical findings or examination findings or imaging findings that I might have to look out for?
The key issue is that one can only diagnose from and identify things that you actually know about. This is a big topic because the cerebral visual impairments, as I've outlined, are myriad. But the key deficits are first, yes, to identify poor acuity for which you haven't got an explanation, to identify low contrast sensitivity for which you haven't got an explanation. And the key which leads you to do this testing is the history. If there's a history of tripping over things, then immediately think of lower visual field impairment. If there is lower visual field impairment, then there's very, very likely to be posterior parietal pathology. And don't accept a 30-degree field. Ask a child who can stand, supported so they don't fall over, to look straight ahead and lift their foot up until they can see it, and you'll be amazed at how many of such children cannot see their feet within a walking step and are walking on clouds for about 2 metres ahead of them if you extrapolate the line from their eye through their foot down to the ground. The next is to think of the posterior parietal problems. Are they inaccurate in their visual guidance? Have they been called dyspraxic when in fact they have optic ataxia? And can they find their mother in a group? Can they find a toy in a toy box? And can they find something pointed out in the distance? Those are the three questions to ask. And then when it comes to reading, maybe they're having difficulty reading, but they can if you put a typoscope down it. Always keep a typoscope or a signature guide, a slot within a black piece of plastic, put it down on the text, even for adults, and you will find there are many adults too who can't read, yet have got normal acuity, who when you put a typoscope down, they can read it. And it tells you that they too have probably got periventricular white matter pathology due to ischemia of one form or other or multiple sclerosis. Moreover, when it comes to the temporal lobes, think about recognition. If a child doesn't recognise faces, they have prosopagnosia, prosopos, Greek for face, agnosia, not to know, topographic agnosia, not to know roots, and so they get lost, they can't recognise faces, and if it's a left temporal lobe lesion, then they may not be able to recognise shapes or objects, despite a good visual acuity. So these are all the questions to have in mind, and as you can see, I'm using anatomy. And so I'm coming finally, as I did last time, to the middle temporal lobes responsible for movement perception. Although it's very crude, first of all, ask whether they can see fast moving objects or whether they walk out in front of cars, which they often do because they don't see them. And then take a hand, put it in front of the child, move it backwards fast to and fro at right angles to their line of gaze, and then put up one, two or three fingers and ask them to count them, gradually slowing it down. And again, you'll be surprised to see how many children cannot count those fingers until it's remarkably slow. But this is very primitive and not a true clinical test, but it gives you a clue of how to investigate further by appropriate radiology, vision evoked potentials, and further assessment of the history of the whether the child was born prematurely, etc. So that's a brief outline of a lot of information.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. Perhaps clinicians who haven't heard your lectures or, who don't listen to this podcast, might be forgiven for making a diagnosis of functional visual loss in these cases. Now, obviously, there's a huge spectrum of disease in this condition, and it can be very, very subtle. In terms of, you know, your experience, you're faced with a child in front of you who is being labelled as having suspected, you know, functional visual loss. You know, what is your approach to reviewing and investigating somebody with query functional visual loss in whom you really don't want to miss an underlying diagnosis?
The key issue is your last line. You don't want to miss a key underlying diagnosis. And so the first thing to think of is, what are the diagnoses that one might not see initially? So carrying out a full history, the origin of the disorder, when it started and how it started. The next is to a full examination, using Cardiff cards, which are wonderful, and I'll explain why. That is that children's eyes can't help but look at Cardiff cards. They don't know that because all the pictures are the same size, they don't know that pictures with thinner lines are actually testing their acuity. And so their eyes move very quickly to each target. And that can give you a huge clue if their acuity measured on a Snellen or whatever other method you're using appears to be low, because that inconsistently stands out a mile. And the next thing to do, of course, is to examine the cornea, anterior segment, posterior segment, optic nerve. Pupils are fundamental. Take a history for cerebral visual impairment, as I've already outlined. And then when you see this inconsistency, that the eyes will move to a target which they say they can't see, you're actually on pretty firm ground. But, and it's a big but, I have in my career seen 3 misdiagnoses. I was fortunate not to have made them myself, but I've seen 3. One was was Stargardt's disease, but it hadn't yet manifested clinically. Another was a progressive optic neuropathy, which hadn't yet manifested clinically. And the third was a craniopharyngioma. So you have to be aware of these possibilities, and of course test the visual fields with a red target in each of the 4 quadrants in the red bi-quadrant test, which is very effective in picking up craniopharyngiomas.
My next question would be, you know, once you've comfortably excluded pathology or disease as a cause of the child's complaint, how would you manage the child or even the family in whom you suspect there is a diagnosis of functional visual loss?
Well, first, it's very important to say that the phrase "exclude a diagnosis" is a very dangerous phrase. You cannot exclude a diagnosis by your assessment. And that's the origin of misdiagnoses all the time. You always suspect that you may be wrong and communicate that too. But I've been lucky, and I was very lucky as a medical student in Bristol to learn from the paediatric psychiatrists a strategy that they taught was standard for functional impairments, visual impairments or motor impairments in children. They explained that what you must do is, with a witness in your room, a nurse helping you, having seen the family together, next to see the child alone with the accompanying person, and to take a history about their concerns, and being kind and very positive with them, and never ever accusatory, because for them this is likely to be real, or perhaps they just wanted a pair of glasses, they went to the optician and they said their acuity was low, so they could get a pair of glasses and got referred. Believe it or not, one medical student actually told me he'd done that and had come to the same department earlier when he was a child. And he actually didn't need glasses, but was wisely given a pair, and that cured him. Anyway, And also one needs to be aware of any form of abuse or anything like that, and very gently take a history of their concerns. Concerns like, my teacher put me down in maths, or my dad's gone away to an oil rig. Brought him back very quickly, it did, losing vision. And then having elicited that, you tell the child that they've got functional visual impairment, and you then say, this is an impairment in visual function. And it always gets better. So I don't think you need to worry about it. And I'll talk to you with your mum and dad in a moment about it. The next thing you come in, you do, is you let them go out and you bring the parents in. You explain that what you've just done, what you've found, unless you've got concern about abuse, which fortunately I don't think I ever saw any evidence of or heard, but I'm sure it is an issue that needs to be addressed and considered. The next thing you do, that I was taught to do, is to give an explanation that the child has functional visual impairment. That is an impairment in visual function. That I may be wrong, because there are subtle disorders that I might not have picked up. And if the child is not better in 2 weeks' time, when they come back to see us briefly, because I'm going to tell them, that child, that he or she has got functional vision impairment, and they're going to see that line on that chart over there. At that point, I'm taking responsibility, not you, the parents. You do not ask questions about it. You'll have no concerns about it. And you treat that child as as your normal child, because the responsibility for the next 2 weeks is mine. And then you bring in the child, and this is to use a positive consultation strategy, which I learned about in the BMJ a number of years ago, and changed my model of approach, and say that this is functional visual impairment. It always gets better. When I see you in 2 weeks' time, you are going to be seeing around that level there. And you ensure that they get that appointment and the absolute certainty. And you also give them the telephone number to phone up, so that they make sure that they're not given a 1 month one or something like that, and that they actually turn up in 2 weeks' time. And then when they turn up, I'd say nearly all of them were better at that line. And that was the model that I was taught as a medical student. But one or two weren't, and we investigated them and we found the cause. And we've written a paper on this topic, which was on vision evoked potentials, measuring visual acuity, and identified one or two in which, yes, we were wrong.
Electrodiagnostic testing, you would say then, is something that you wouldn't do immediately. It's something that you'd wait and see if it was needed.
Well, that's why I said you have to be absolutely certain they're going to come back and keep a diary of them and not lose them. But the difficulty with taking this condition that seriously is you're affirming in their minds that there's something profoundly the matter to bring them back for electrophysiology. And that can make it persist. I've heard of a number of teachers who've told me that they have a number of children in their region who've got functional visual impairment, and they're teaching them in blind schools. During my career, no such child ever existed. I'm very conscious that this approach is not in literature. I never actually published it myself, actually, but it was the approach I was taught.
Gordon, that's been really, really interesting and a really, really inspiring discussion. You know, but before we finish, I was just wondering whether you might be so kind as to, you know, perhaps share with the listeners three pearls or three take-home messages that, you know, might be useful in everyday practice, either when seeing patients or children with cerebral visual impairment or with functional visual loss.
I think the first one is, the pearl is, that the book Sherlock Holmes, the author was an eye surgeon. How did Sherlock Holmes practice? He practiced by having prior knowledge of everything. One can only diagnose something that one has heard of. And the idea that that your knowledge is sufficient to make a diagnosis, and that the person may be putting it on, is incorrect. I've always believe patients when they tell you something, and then investigate them thoroughly and look it up. So that's a key message. Do not, I strongly recommend, ever say, they're putting it on, or they are telling lies. That is a very poor approach to use, because it's storing up problems for later. So that is actually dealing with functional visual loss, because the next pearl for functional visual loss is they believe they can't see, or they're stuck in a bind that they want to get out of because they went to see the optician pretending, and they can't, they've got to be given permission to escape from their condition. When it comes to cerebral visual impairment, the key for cerebral visual impairment is that nobody can learn from what they do not see. We use vision for three things. We use vision, one, to access information. So when you write to anybody with poor vision, always use a print size above the size you've just measured they can't see, adult and child alike. When you prescribe drugs, always ensure that they have drugs with prescriptions and instructions they can read. We don't do that, but we should. We use vision for social interaction, and so that is to convey smiles and such. And children that can't see smiles cannot learn about your feelings and emotions. And so you need to explain them. You need to use radio language. Radio, listen to the radio, you understand everything. Close your eyes and listen to the TV, you do not. Most parents are TV parents. And so for all visual impairment, those parents need to learn that to use a radio parenting voice which explains everything so that they do not bring about problems from learning owing to the fact that they are assuming that their child sees as they do. And then finally, we use vision to guide our movements. And so for young people with very poor vision, they need to be given reach on sound, tactile methods, and even white sticks for at a very early age, although that is controversial.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much for discussing it with me today. It's been really interesting.
You're most welcome.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.